Hey everyone, thanks for listening to Radiolab, and thank you to all of you who have chipped in to help support the show. Listener contributions are the reason we can do this, so thanks.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
All right.
Okay, so let's just do the open.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today we're going to be talking, well, let's do it this way.
Which way?
I was at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, gathering spot for cool people with new books. And that particular week
is Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins.
They like him.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make it so easy for him.
I decided to begin.
This is a real problem for a lot of people.
By quoting him to him.
You write, I don't know if it's in this book or some other, the total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, disease. It must be so. If there's ever a time of plenty, this very fact will automatically lead to an increase in population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored. Whew.
Darwin was worried by the same thing. I mean, Darwin recognized the total horror of the suffering in nature. It was one of the things that actually made him lose his faith. But he also realized that it's not just a fact that it happens, it's intrinsic to natural selection that it must happen. And when you look at a beautiful animal like a cheetah that appears to be beautifully designed for something, like a cheetah is amazingly well designed apparently for catching gazelles, and gazelles are amazingly well designed for escaping from cheetahs, that they are the end products of a sort of evolutionary arms race in which thousands, millions of animals have died. The shaping, the carving of the shape of a cheetah or a gazelle has come about through millions of unsuccessful gazelles being caught and the successful ones making it through, only to be caught later probably, but after reproducing and passing on the genes that helped them to escape. So the sheer number of deaths that lie behind the sculpting of these beautiful creatures is horrifying, and at the same time it's got a kind of savage beauty.
Why did you blame this exactly?
Well, because I was sitting there thinking, I know the cheetahs chase and eat antelopes, but wasn't there a nice cheetah once that went over to the antelope and said, hi, have a sandwich together, and that maybe something about the cheetah and had something to do with an act of kindness? I can't imagine.
So you're thinking that maybe it's not just meanness that can sculpt, but maybe niceness can sculpt too.
Exactly. Niceness as a scalpel.
Niceness as a scalpel.
Ooh.
I want to listen to that show.
All right.
Wait a second. We are that show. We should do it then. Let's do it. Today on Radiolab. Goodness.
Kindness.
Selflessness.
Altruism.
If the world is so cruel, how do you account for it?
Yeah.
How should we think about it?
And when you do see generosity, how do you know it's really generous?
All right, so we're going to start the show with a story that sort of embodies the last question you asked about a guy named George Price, who is a mathematician we never heard of until our producer, Lynn Levy, told us about him. She heard about it from an author, Orrin Harman, who wrote a book called The Price, as in George Price, of altruism.
Check it out. You know, this is a high school photo.
So, okay, so the people on the radio can't see the picture. So describe what he looks like.
Well, I tell you, he looks a bit like sort of some kind of Scandinavian prince in the 17th century. Good looking guy.
Totally. Definitely something about this guy's eyes.
His eyes.
Yeah.
This was described to me by a number of people who knew him. He had a gaze that you sort of walked away from at your own peril. There was something that, you know, he sort of knew things.
You could start George's story anywhere, but let's start in 1943.
Okay.
George graduates from college, and he's this
very kinetic kind of guy.
Really athletic.
He'd swim in the surf, and he did a lot of rock climbing.
And by all accounts, he was
incredibly brilliant.
And right after college, he starts to kind of bounce through history.
He was all over the place.
First place he ends up is
the Manhattan Project on uranium enrichment. So he was working as a chemist on the atom bomb. When he was done with that,
after a couple of years,
he made a 90-degree turn and started working at Bell Labs on transistor research. Solved some very basic problems there and then disappeared like a phantom. Started working at a medical center on oncology research.
Meaning cancer.
And I remember going to his lab, playing hide and seek, all these bottles and TEPS tubes.
By this time, George had a wife and two kids.
You look under the microscope at slides of blood.
Anna and Kathleen. But he never really saw them that much.
He'd work 56 hours straight without sleeping on Benzedrine.
And I remember he was always
stuff like that.
Gone a lot.
Mm. When the kids were still pretty young.
We were like 5 and 6.
He
left his family.
Yeah.
Just left.
Turned another 90-degree corner and began working on computer-aided design. In fact, he invented computer-aided design. He was firing in all directions.
What do you think was driving him to keep moving from thing to thing?
He just wanted to succeed at any cost. It made no difference in what field. And at one point in time, he was corresponding with about 5 Nobel laureates, each in a different field. He wanted to have one great discovery that would make his name.
So that's George.
Wow, quite a guy.
Very interesting guy.
So what happens next?
So next, what happens is he gets on a boat and he goes to London.
When was this, by the way?
It's November 1967. Yeah. And in London, that's where things, for our purposes, start to really happen.
Boy, what happens in London?
Well, he starts looking for this question. He goes from library to library. There are 13 libraries that he would hang out at. And the question that he finds for himself, which is weird considering his personal history, is...
Why family?
Like, why do people have families?
Well, like, why do families stick together?
There are a lot of sort of dynamics within the family where it would make more sense for an individual to sort of break out.
You know, go it alone. Like he had.
And yet family persists. And there should be a good reason for it.
He even wrote about the question to his daughter.
Dear Kathleen, my big paper will be on the evolutionary origin of the human family. In most species, the father just mates with the mother and she does all the child rearing herself. But in the human species, the dominant pattern has involved care by adult males toward their own children. Why did our species evolve this way? You know, it just brings back what kind of a father our father was towards us. And basically, there was kind of this benign neglect.
Hmm. But this question, why family, was only the beginning. Why family led him to a bigger question, which is, why does anybody help anybody?
Huh. Well, what do you mean?
If you think about Darwin's idea, survival of the fittest,
mm-hmm.
think about what that really means. It means if you are a creature, you have 2 big important jobs.
You got to survive and you got to be fit.
Right.
Whatever that means.
Fitness really means how many babies can you make? How many babies are you making? And so if you do some stupid, you know, harebrained thing that means you can't stay alive and or you can't make babies, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And yet, wherever you look in nature...
You see creatures doing this.
From bacteria.
To insects.
Birds.
Bees.
Ants and wasps. Fish. I'll give you an example. There's a species of amoeba called Discotelium discoideum, which usually the amoeba sort of lives on its own. It's a single-celled organism in the forest.
Mm-hmm.
But when resources are low, what it does is it sends out this chemical signal. And all the other amoeba, who are also single-celled,
they start sending out signals.
And they start sort of crawling until they all meet and they become one slug, which is now a single organism.
And this slug begins to sort of move along until it finds a place that's windy and sunny. at which point
it stops. And the top 20% of the slug, the top 20% amoeba in the head of the slug, begin to create out of their own body a stalk. Which hardens. And they die while doing so. But the stalk allows the bottom 80% to climb up the stalk and to create an orb at the top of the stalk.
And from there, all the amoeba that aren't, you know, dead, they can catch a wind.
To better pastures.
It's like a dandelion.
So what's happened is that the top 20% have really sacrificed themselves for the back 80%. And that's an amoeba. So you figure, what the hell is happening here? This was a great mystery to Darwin, and Darwin said, this is in fact the greatest mystery and the greatest riddle, and if I can't answer it, then my theory isn't worth anything.
And for 100 years, when people talked about evolution, this thing, altruism, was the elephant in the room.
Should we just jump in?
So we were curious about this.
Sorry, I'm...
How might you take this elephant, this niceness thing that seems to be everywhere, and shove it back into the mean old theory of evolution? There's got to be a way. And so we called up Carl Zimmer, who's a journalist we have on the show quite often, who writes a lot about evolution. And he told us that in the 1960s, just as George Price was starting to ask these questions, some scientists came up with a new way of thinking about altruism, a thought experiment, which he ran us through.
Okay, so Robert, yeah. Do you have siblings?
I have a sister.
Okay, you have a sister.
Sarah.
Okay, let's just imagine that. You guys are like home from college, say.
Okay.
And there's a flood at the Crulwich Manor. And the water's flooding around and you can see that your sister is about to die. If you save your sister's life and you die in the process, your genes, Robert Crulwich's genes, are gone.
Yep.
Right. This is the problem.
Yes. But you and your sister... have the same parents.
Yes.
Okay. So your sister has 50% of your genes.
So if I rescue her, then half my genes survive?
Right. 50% move on.
Ah.
Now, if you had a sister and a brother and you saved them both, they'd each have 50%.
So it's a wash. Oh,
and it's so it's wash. Effectively, it's like saving Robert Crulwich in his entirety.
Mathematically speaking,
right.
Can you do this with cousins?
Yeah, actually. If you step it back to cousins.
What percentage? That's a quarter in the case of the first cousins? That is?
It's an eighth.
So I have to have eight cousins. First cousins to equal my full genome.
Right.
And can you keep going with this? Can you say 16 second cousins equals one Robert Crulwich?
Yeah.
Do you have that many?
I have 32 third cousins, and that's why I always round them up at a rodeo every year. And
you place them all together.
You guys stay here in case something happens to me.
But here's what I don't get. Like, how does this actually operate? Like, Robert's not going to sit there while the manor is flooding and be like, well, let's see. I have a cousin that's an eighth and a second cousin that's a 32nd.
No, so you understand. The math has already been done. The math has been done by evolution on genes. And those are the genes you got.
Mm. Oh, so you're saying that that evolution has turned the math into an instinct.
Yeah, you got it.
I don't think I get it. Like, so what is the instinct here? I know I want to save my sister.
Yeah, well, so here's how I understand it. Since sis has half your genes,
yeah.
And since second cousin only has a 16th,
yeah.
Theoretically, your instinct to save your sis should be 8 times stronger. Then your instinct to save.
No, that's actually roughly proportionally correct.
Really? But keep in mind, this was just an idea. It's just a thought experiment. Until our guy, George Price, comes along and writes an equation which shows mathematically how an instinct like this could evolve.
It's very powerful. Okay, so, well, do you want me to just read the letters?
Yeah.
What is the equation? What equals what?
Okay.
Okay, so it's...
W times delta Z
equals the covariance
of W... I, comma, ZI.
Plus?
E.
We call it E.
WI delta ZI.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
There you go.
Lynn?
Uh-huh.
Why is it so complicated? I mean, it was simple a second ago.
No, it sounds a little complicated. He's not just dealing with like a simple setup. It's like he's got the traits and how they affect the different groups and how things change over time. So there's a lot going on in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Do you understand what you just said?
Not.
So here, this is a really interesting letter. Which
When he did write the equation, he walked off the street into the university.
College of the University of London.
In London,
complete unknown.
Had just moved from America. No one knew who he was.
I went to talk to a Professor Smith.
And he showed the equation to the professor and said, "Is this new?"
I felt sure that someone must have discovered it before.
The professor looked at it, and after a very, very short amount of minutes, gave him an honorary professorship
and the keys to
an office. One of the best genetics departments in the world.
So George is sitting in his office, which, by the way, is on the site of Darwin's old house.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he's made this big discovery, and he's thinking. Thinking. Thinking.
Thinking philosophically about what it all meant.
Thinking. Thinking.
If I can write a formal mathematical treatment of the evolution of a trait like altruism, what it means about the trait is that the trait is never really purely altruistic.
If making a sacrifice helps me in the end, or helps my genes...
Sort of like selfishness in disguise.
Yeah.
If that's true, the world is a terrible place. Because it means that there's no true... There could never be true selflessness in the world. My math means that there cannot ever be true selflessness. And I can't accept a world like that.
Why could he suddenly not accept a world like that?
I don't know. Oren thinks it might be because...
Precisely because he had been so selfish for most of his life. And so he decided in his own life to embark on a program of radical altruism that would prove that there was true selflessness in this world. And that's what led him to the streets of London. In search of homeless people, derelicts, down and outs. And he began by sort of just walking up to them, introducing himself. Hello, my name is George. What's your name? How can I help you?
To random people on the street?
Yeah.
Everywhere I go, I keep running into down and out alcoholics, to whom I give when I have anything and with whom I sit and drink from their bottle if they offer me a drink.
He'd buy people sandwiches or give them a few pounds.
Whether it's by giving them money, cleaning a filthy kitchen.
And then it got bigger.
He started giving out keys to his place.
Inviting these guys into his home.
People were coming and going. He was giving them food, clothes. And after a few months of charity like that, he was out of money.
There was one letter that he had written to John Maynard Smith, another great biologist of the era, which said, "John, I'm down to my last 15p, and I can't wait to get rid of the last 15.
Huh.
He thought he was proving his equation wrong.
So by getting poorer and poorer and giving away all this stuff, he was somehow negating the thing his math seemed to say was inevitable, the selfish instinct?
Yeah. You know, he had this self-preservation instinct, and he was going to fight the self-preservation instinct, and he was going
to
win.
To sort of beat the mathematics that he himself had written.
So he was approaching it almost like a math proof.
Yeah.
Just the red one that you'll be talking into.
When he ran out of money, George moved out of his apartment and into this abandoned house in a part of London called Tolmer's Square.
Which one does the volume for my headphones?
Which is where he met Sylvia.
It was rough. There were just poles holding the walls up. Some places had walls.
She was a young artist, also squatting at the time.
And the buildings are crumbling, you know. People had made makeshift staircases.
And George had, like, a room?
Well, a few clothes on the floor, not much. But, you know, you could see he was always thinking. He would go around asking other people, does anybody have shoes they don't want? So-and-so needs a pair of shoes. You know, that would be part of it. But it might also be like if somebody was sick, getting him to a doctor. Because if you were homeless, it's very hard to have a doctor. But like I say, all this is going on at the same time. He was getting thinner and thinner. His thin little neck and these clothes that just hung around him.
Hmm. He began writing letters to his daughters.
Apologizing, weeping,
Dear Henry, sorry I deserted you like that, and I'm sorry I was such a poor father to you.
Yeah, I've been a terrible father.
Looking at your picture now makes me wish I could do it all over again.
Maybe where I come into the picture is he wanted to begin again.
She says George asked her to marry him over and over.
At first I thought it was kind of a joke. And I was saying, George, we can't get married, you know.
She said no each time, and at a certain point, he gave up.
It's hard to really, really remember, but it was colder. As the winter came on, you wouldn't see George as often. He became quieter, I think. I just remember I'm quieter.
One morning, this guy that was sharing a squat with George.
Name is Shmuli Katia.
He was heading out the door.
He found beneath the door, as he was going out of the building, he found beneath the door a letter. And since they were living in a squat, he was afraid that this was some kind of eviction notice or something like that. And he didn't read English. He couldn't read English. So he ran up the stairs and knocked on George's door, because George was the only one who could read English. And when he knocked, the door sort of kind of went in a bit. And he could see in the aperture that there was blood all over the linoleum floor. When he had enough of an opening, he could see that George was sitting there with no blood left in his body.
He killed himself?
Yeah.
He took a pair of scissors and cut through his carotid artery, which is a very, very sort of terrible death. Poor George.
Thanks to producer Lynn Levy. For more on George Price, be sure to read Oren Harman's book, The Price of Altruism. And thanks also to Carl Zimmer. His latest is Microcosm.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Emily Price.
This is Kathleen Price. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
Enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
This is Oren calling. Radiolab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by NPR. This is Carl Zimmer. Bye.
Thanks for listening. You can keep up with all things Radiolab at radiolab.org or follow us on Twitter and Facebook.